Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A quick note before we start. Next week will be our annual Halloween episode, where we take a look at the spiritual in some odd and spooky directions. And that show will not disappoint because we are featuring Peter Leeson, an economist at George Mason University, talking about medieval witchcraft trials and human sacrifice. I wonder what an economist would say about that. Well, we've already recorded that interview, so I know for a fact that you will find it very interesting and fun, so please check it out next Sunday. My guest today, however, is Michael Cromartie, Vice President of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and Director of two of their initiatives, the Faith Angle Forum and the Evangelicals in Civic Life Program. His name came to my attention as a possible guest based upon an earlier podcast on the life and times of Chuck Colson that we did with Owen Strachan. Mr. Cromartie was a key advisor to Colson dating back to the 1970s, and his name came up frequently in that interview. Michael is a prolific author and editor, being a regular contributor to publications such as Christianity Today, The Washington Post, and First Things, as well as putting together important edited volumes such as Religion and Politics in America, Religion, Culture, and International Conflict, and A Public Faith, Evangelicals and Civic Engagement. He also served a 6-year term at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, being twice elected the chair, and is a senior advisor to the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. Mr. Cromartie can also be seen and heard frequently in the news media, appearing on places such as NPR's All Things Considered, NBC Evening News, and The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And now he crowns all of those achievements with an appearance on Research on Religion. Now, I could go on with his biography, but that would leave us very little time to talk with the man himself, which is what we are here to do. So instead, I will just nudge you to our website, www.researchonreligion.org, to see links to his biography, his writings, and many other fun and interesting things. Michael, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Anthony. It's good to be here. By the way, and so my relatives will not be upset, the last name is actually pronounced Cromartie.
Cromartie?
Scotland.
Oh, you're
all those NFL football players who pronounce it Cromartie are actually wrong.
Ah, okay. So here I thought you had a great link to a great linebacker, but Cromartie. Okay. And that's the proper Scottish pronunciation.
Yeah, that's the proper Scottish pronunciation. But, okay. I hear it all the time, so it's no problem.
Okay. Well, that's one thing that we're going to correct here. And do they, in like places like the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, do they get that right?
Yes, because they interview me at length beforehand.
I should have done that. And one of my failings here is not being able to interview at length beforehand because we've been playing some email tag back and forth. You're a very busy person. We usually don't have time to get many big fish into our small pond here, but you graciously agreed to do that. And I want to thank you for taking the time to do that.
Glad to do so.
Great. So let's dig right into it. And one of the major points of emphasis that you do in your own writing has been the topic of religion and the media. And before we dive into your background, which I find absolutely fascinating, some of the things that you are doing with the Ethics and Public Policy Center, I'd like to get your take on the recent visit by the Pontiff to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. Now, I mentioned that we had emailed back and forth a few times, and in one of those emails, you mentioned that you were poped out. And I love that term because I think it was a couple weeks ago when the Pope was here, I was getting news fatigue as well. So I used the term poped out a few times and people thought it was rather humorous. And I credit you with that. So I'm not going to ask you to talk directly about Pope Francis and what he said, but instead, let's take a different angle on this. And I was wondering if after a few weeks of reflection, you could share some of your thoughts on how the media covered the Pope.
Yes, well, and as you know, he got lots of press and all the major media outlets. There's extreme fascination on the part of the press by this Pope because they can't quite get a handle on him. You know, they, but they're fascinated by him because the man exudes such wonderful pastoral concern for people. The way he was named Pope and his response to that, his lack of ostentation in every way, his insistence in living in a, instead of living in a Pope palace in the Vatican, but living in a modest, I guess, condo. Everything about the Pope that sort of strikes us is the way that we see Jesus in the Gospels is intriguing to believers and non-believers alike, especially in the media. And so the Pope is widely admired, as you know, by people across the political and religious persuasions. And so I, as a non-Catholic, enjoy watching my Catholic colleagues, both here at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and people outside of our office, you know, interpret this Pope, and they're trying to figure out where he's going to go with the Church doctrinally and also politically, and his concerns of various political causes, which Catholics who are left of center embrace. But then this Pope, we mustn't forget, while he was here, besides speaking on climate change and concerns for immigration, also talked about the traditional family and his pro-life convictions. And so he said enough to encourage people on the right and the left. And when the media tries to interpret him, it's often interesting because they don't quite know how to peg him. And the media does like to sort of at least say where they think a person's coming from. But this Pope is confounding, I think, to the media. They admire him. They like him. They like some of the things he says about immigration and the climate and about income inequality. But they have to admit that he also believes in certain traditional Catholic moral absolutes, which they seem to want to play down. But he's not, you know, ultimately a man of the cultural and moral left at all. So I just think that it's fun, Anthony, to watch the media trying to interpret him. But one thing I do think that's impressive about this Pope is they do seem to admire him. You know, he's got this wonderful pastoral ability to embrace people of all walks of life. And it's striking, you know, when anyone in the Christian world and community acts like Jesus, people are drawn to it.
It might be one of the attractions there, and it might be one of the attractions that brings him to the attention of a lot of people across the denominational spectrum, which I want to ask in a second. But I'm interested in the secular media, and you are there in Washington, D.C., and you get to see the secular media swarming for every single story, every single day, looking for a different angle on things. And one of the news tropes that has been out there in the world for the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, is the decline of religiosity in America. They talk about the rise of the nuns and millennials are not going to church as much. It must be surprising to the secular media when the Pope comes to town to see throngs of people just lined up to see this guy. How do they put that together? I don't know if you actually get to talk to any people directly about this in the secular news media, but it must be some kind of a challenge to their worldview on things.
Well, indeed it is. But and while the fact of the matter is, as you mentioned, the rise of what are called the nuns, spelled N-O-N-E-S, for our listeners, not N-U-N-S. The rise of the nuns. Nuns are people who, when surveyed, are people who say they have no particular religious affiliation at all. And that number has, the Pew Research Center has shown, increased, and it's almost up to 20%. It's about 20% of Americans who call themselves nuns, and this is sociologically significant, but it's still not the majority of Americans. And so when the media finds out there are people out there who identify self-identify as nuns, and then a widely admired Pope comes to town and people flock, what we have to remember is that America is still a very incorrigibly religious country. And people are still, America is still, despite secularization, still a very dynamically religious country. And so just because we've seen a spike in the rise of the nuns, you know, 70, 75% of the country still identifies as religious. So that can't be forgotten, and we see it highlighted when somebody like Pope Francis comes to Washington and New York and Philadelphia.
And when it comes to covering the Pope, you had a chance to observe what was going on. Were there some things that you thought were overcovered or undercovered by the, and I'm talking about the secular mainstream media here, I'll turn a minute to the religious media, but were there some certain things that were overcovered or undercovered that you scratch your head saying, I wonder why they're focusing on that and not the other thing, and do you have some explanations for that?
Well, yeah, I think it's clear they undercovered the fact that while this Pope may be economically influenced a bit by liberation theology and therefore economically left of center, they really highlight that, and they undercover the fact that he still believes in core Catholic teachings on the makeup of the traditional family, that he's very pro-life from beginning of life to end of life, and you ask, have those things been undercovered? And indeed they have. You know, they want to highlight the more politically correct things that the Pope says, and they don't seem to highlight that, you know, the President would not have agreed with the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. I mean, I'm sorry, the Pope would have not agreed with the Supreme Court on gay marriage. And so they admire him so much, and they don't want to talk about those parts. And so those are the parts that are undercovered, those parts that the conservative, morally and culturally conservative parts of Catholic and Christian doctrine, those seem to be underplayed, and the fact that he's a strong believer in immigration and concern for climate change and for income equality, those get played up, and these others seem to be played down. Now, how do we explain that? Well, the way to explain it is because every empirical social science study done of our mainstream media is that the media is largely biased, 85% to 90% politically liberal. So it stands to reason they would want to highlight those parts of his agenda that comports with their own.
I think one of the other things, too, that a lot of social science finds is that the media tends to be overwhelmingly secular as well. There's a disproportionate...
Yeah, overwhelmingly secular and overwhelmingly liberal politically, and yes, yeah. I meant to say also overwhelmingly secular.
Yeah, and that, I think, is going to come up later when we talk about your own initiative, the Faith Angle Forum.
Precisely why we did it was because of that data.
Yeah, yeah. And so we'll talk about that in a second, but I want to turn to the religious media now, because it's not just the New York Times and the Washington Post out there, but magazines like Christianity Today and EWTN, and there's even some evangelical networks that are out there that look at the Pope. And how did they react to the Pope's visit? Did you see any difference in coverage, or did it largely mirror what the mainstream media was doing?
I mean, it mirrored what the mainstream media did, in the sense that it highlighted the popularity of Pope Francis and the size of the crowds and the intrigue by people at the UN and the U.S. Congress and in Philadelphia with every word the man said and every private meeting he had. I think, though, that the religious media takes it a step further and wants to talk more than the mainstream secular media about the Pope's positions theologically. And they therefore try to track, you know, more about the biography of the Pope and his time in Argentina and what he might be doing to reform the Church, especially at the Vatican. The Pope has insisted on many reforms in the Vatican. And so the religious media, understandably, would talk more about the theological positions of the Pope. And I think there you find, especially in the evangelical Protestant world, you know, people of two minds, people who have been anti-Catholic for a long time, want to critique the Pope theologically and in every way possible. But then you have, I think, a large growing number of conservative Protestants who actually do admire this Pope and his wonderful, winsome, compassionate, magnanimous pastoral spirit. And so in many evangelical circles you see admiring profiles of the Pope, and I think that's all to the good.
That is a fascinating phenomenon that I have to mention as well, because one would think that with the media coverage on the Pope's economic issues, you get some conservative evangelicals starting to say, well, I don't know, this Pope is really not my guy. But on the other hand, he takes these other cultural positions. And as you mentioned, his winsome personality of going forth and working with the poor, which supposedly is not a conservative evangelical tradition, but in reality it is. And I'm wondering to what extent if some of the evangelical community look toward Pope Francis and say, you know, this is actually what we do. We do this on a daily basis. We had Jay Hine on here a couple months ago, and he was talking about how evangelicals get very much involved with the poor and prison communities out there in society, and that's somewhat overlooked. Is there an opening that the evangelical community can link with Pope Francis and say, hey, you need to look at all the different dimensions of who we are?
Absolutely right. And I mean, the Pope has called the church to be what he calls a field hospital, attending to those wounded by 21st century culture and society. And the various branches of that field hospital, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, who have homes for indigent elderly people, the Pope visited it while he was in Washington. He visited a school for underprivileged kids in New York, and he visited Catholic Charities, where he gave a blessing at lunch for the homeless in the nation's capital. Evangelicals deeply admire this, and as you know from the history of evangelical social concern, evangelicals have been in soup kitchens for a very long time, and go all the way back to the reforms of Lord Shaftesbury and William Wilberforce in England. As you know, World Vision's headquarters are out there near you in Seattle. Evangelicals have a long history of being concerned for the poor throughout the world. Whenever there's a major earthquake or tsunami, right after the Red Cross gets there, some of the groups that are there also are evangelical relief organizations. And so when the Pope emphasizes this, evangelicals readily resonate with it and admire a Pope who cancels visits with VIPs and dignitaries to go visit with the Little Sisters of the Poor, or to go to Catholic Charities to give a blessing at a lunch for homeless people in the nation's capital. These things are also highlighted by the press, and people admire it. And so you see a Pope who moves comfortably with the powerful and the wealthy, but also who insists that I will go meet with the people that Jesus would have met with. And so even before he came to America, we know that in Rome he washed the feet of Muslim prisoners, and he cared for that man with the deformed body. And these symbolic gestures, when covered by the media, even skeptical non-believers have to resonate with it and admire it. And evangelicals resonated with that too, because while evangelicals believe greatly in evangelism, they also believe deeply in caring for the least of these, and so in that aspect would admire the Pope for his behavior while he was here.
And As I mentioned, I do think this is an opportunity for evangelicals to somewhat reshape the way that they are viewed in society by connecting with that aspect of the Pope. And that brings me to the next thing that I want to talk to you about, and that's somebody who you worked with for a very long period of time, Chuck Colson, who did very much the same thing. As you mentioned, he walked with the powers that be. He was in the Nixon administration, but he also was there washing the feet of the poor, so to speak. He worked in the prison ministries and really could walk back and forth between those two worlds. Now, we've talked a great deal about Chuck Colson on a previous podcast with Owen Strachan, and I will point folks back to that, and we'll link to it on our website. But I'm interested in how you became connected with Chuck Colson and a little bit of your background. I'm always fascinated by people's life's histories and figuring out how they got from point A to point B. Give us a little bit of your own personal religious background. What did you do as a teenager and growing up in college? Where did you envision your life to be? And then how did you get connected with Chuck Colson?
Well, there's, Anthony, a lot of surprises. I mean, I became a Christian believer my senior in high school through an organization called Young Life. I went to high school in Atlanta. I then went off to Georgia State University in Atlanta, and it was there that I almost got drafted to the war in Vietnam. because I had a low draft number, but I also, at the time, as a new Christian, began reading all kinds of literature on Christian pacifism. And anyway, I was reading literature on Christian pacifism, and I became a Christian pacifist, which I am not now, but conveniently then I was. And so I spent 2 years doing alternative service to the war in Vietnam and living in an intentional Christian commune. And it was in that commune where I read a lot of people like John Howard Yoder and the Berrigan brothers, and I was theologically and politically on the left. But then while living in that commune, I also read a man named Francis Schaeffer, who helped, at least at that time, guide me theologically to a more conservative Orthodox understanding of the Christian tradition. And through reading Schaeffer, I went and heard him speak at a small Christian college in Lookout Mountain, Jordan, called Covenant College. And since I had dropped out of college and done a 2-year alternative service, I needed to go back to college. So I went back to Covenant College, which is a small Presbyterian Christian school near Chattanooga, and spent 3 years there, and that was where I actually majored, not in political science or public policy, but in psychology. And I actually played college basketball at Covenant College and graduated a degree in psychology. And a friend of mine said, when you finish at Covenant College, come to Washington and spend a year with us before you go to seminary. So I came to Washington to work with a group called the Fellowship Foundation, which sponsors the National Prayer Breakfast. And while here, first month I was here, he said, there's a man who just got out of prison named Chuck Colson. He needs a research assistant. I want you to go out and meet him. So I went out to Virginia and I met Chuck Colson as a newly graduated major in psychology from Covenant College. I met Chuck Colson, who needed somebody to help draft speeches for him. And I became Chuck's research assistant. It was supposed to be a temporary job, but Chuck said, I want you to stay on. And so for 4 years, I traveled the country with Chuck Colson, visiting prisons, both state prisons and federal prisons. You'd be interested, Anthony, during that time when traveling Chuck Colson, I was actually bound and gagged and tied up in my hotel room in Denver, Colorado. And that experience of being mugged actually changed my worldview politically.
Hmm.
You know, the great Jewish public intellectual Irving Kristol said, a neoconservative who is a liberal who's been mugged. I actually was a liberal mugged in reality. And nothing like an experience of being violated that caused me to start reading differently, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, you know, the world really did have some bad people in it, and one needed to watch out. I survived that experience, but I do mean it when I say it affected my thinking and my view of the world and even my reading habits. And so I worked for Chuck Colson for 4 years, and after that I went to graduate school at American University here in Washington and got a degree in what's called the School of Justice, a Master's in Justice, which is kind of a combination of political theory and criminal justice. After that, I attended some conferences by the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and one day got a phone call from their senior editor who said, we want you to come to a dinner tonight to hear your friend Oz Guinness speak. And I was at home at the time, miserably sick, and called my wife and said, you know, we've been invited to this dinner, but I don't think I can make it since I've been sick all day. She said, we need to go. I tell you this story, Anthony, because what happened at the dinner was the founder of the Ethics and Public Policy Center came up to me and I said, how are things at the center? He said, we need two things, a director of development and a director of evangelical Protestant studies. I said, well, I'm actually in a job search. What are the requirements? And he told me, and I told him that the evangelical theologian Carl Henry was a friend of mine, who also happened to be on the board of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and then I worked for Chuck Colson for 4 years, and he said, come see me for an interview. Well, that was over 30 years ago, and I came in for an interview, and I've been here ever since.
Mm.
So what's interesting about all that is I want to say that, you know, to young people listening to the program, you know, psychology is not the best preparation for a public policy position in Washington, a psychology degree. But I will say that 4 years traveling the globe with Chuck Colson and meeting inmates and listening to Chuck speak both at prayer breakfasts and meet with political officials and also with the down and out in prisons was an incredible, almost graduate school education in itself for me to be introduced to the world of Washington public policy.
It seems to be one of those stories that God opens certain doors, and you just got to be looking where those doors are opened and take the opportunity to walk through those.
Absolutely. I mean, I did not, many of these things, when I look back on them, I didn't map them out, I didn't network them, I didn't plan them. But, you know, I could have not have thought when I was a senior in college, the next thing you're going to do is go work for a former member of the Nixon administration who spent 7 months in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to become his chief first research assistant and travel not only throughout the country, but to England and France visiting prisons and have an eye-opening experience like that. I did not orchestrate that, and so I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happened with my position at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. You know, I agreed to come to a dinner where my friend Oz Guinness was speaking, and little did I know that they actually invited me to dinner because they wanted to interview me, I was told later. But again, there, I almost didn't go to the dinner because I'd been ill for a week, and my wife insisted we go, and I met the president. And so that's one of those moments, those providential moments where you say, isn't that interesting? I didn't really map that out.
Yeah.
It just occurred, the door opened, and one walks through it.
It is somewhat,
I've been grateful ever since.
Yeah, it is somewhat interesting how those stories come about, because right now, as you mentioned, you have a cold, and I think you were at a dinner last night with Oz Guinness again, if that was correct, right?
I was with Oz at a conference at Georgetown, and the night before I was at a dinner with Peter Berger, who was one of the speakers at the conference, and coughing and hacking throughout. But I did go see my doctor yesterday, and I'm now on antibiotics because it's more than just a cold, but we're doing pretty good so far.
All right. Well, we hope you get through that. That connects me now with what you're doing with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm very interested in religious think tanks, what they do, how they do those things. And there is a stream of thought in American life that takes the notion that the separation of church and state is instrumental to the American way. And a lot of folks then argue that religious people should keep their faith private and not take it into the public square. But, you know, that seems a little bit silly given that it's difficult to separate out our deepest spiritual values from what we do in the ballot box, what we do in everyday life, and working with the government and such. But nonetheless, one still has to recognize that religious folks need to tread carefully when it comes to the world of politics, because that world can have a potentially adverse effect on religion if you link yourself too close to a single politician or a single party. The vagaries of what happens to that politician or that party can have a tarnishing effect on the religious organization as well. So it's a very difficult line to tread. And I'm wondering how the Ethics and Public Policy Center treads this line. And first of all, give us an idea of what the EPPC does, how it was founded, when it was founded, and what its general goals are.
Yes, well, it was founded in 1976 by a man named Dr. Ernest Lefevre, who did his PhD in Christian ethics at Yale Divinity School, studying under Richard Niebuhr. He founded it with the late former Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick and the Princeton ethicist Paul Ramsey. And in 76, they were concerned with the election of Jimmy Carter as president, who was a born-again Baptist president, that they themselves felt that Carter's religious views were sincere, but his foreign policy views were not, they were not in much agreement with his views on foreign policy. And so they said, you know, we need to found a think tank that focuses on religious bodies and what they say about public life. So the Ethics and Public Policy Center is not a quote, religious think tank or Christian think tank, but it's a think tank that employs believers of various traditions to take seriously and look at religious believers in the public square and the different bodies that issue statements on public life and to critique those views from a Judeo-Christian moral tradition. So in that sense, the center was founded at a time when especially mainline Protestant groups had lobbies on Capitol Hill and were constantly making pronouncements about everything related to politics and foreign policy. And the founders of the Ethics and Public Policy Center felt like that these were people that were making really unsound and poorly judged comments about foreign relations, and they were moving out of their area of expertise, and it needed to be critiqued and critiqued quickly. So Dr. Lefevre wrote several books critiquing the foreign policy of the World Council of Churches, and also of the National Council of Churches. And then out of that, with the rise of the Christian right in politics, that's when he said, you know, we need somebody here to do evangelicals in politics. And so that's where they found me in 1985, to focus on the rise of conservative evangelicals and fundamentalists in politics. So it's a think tank that takes seriously the role that religion plays in American life today, and that it's played in American history. As you said in the introduction to this segment, you know, it is simply not the case that the separation of church and state means the separation of religious believers from the public square. Separation of church and state means the separation of church and state, but it does not mean that individual believers cannot bring their core convictions into public conversation. If that were the case, then Martin Luther King's concern about civil rights, to give one example, would have been illegitimate. And so religious believers of whatever persuasion have every right to bring their worldview and their religious convictions to the public conversation. And, you know, I've been influenced a lot by the late Father Richard John Newhouse, whose book, The Naked Public Square, made this argument in a very winsome and compelling way, that the public square must not be naked and exclude religious values and religious convictions from our everyday ethical and moral dilemmas. And so one of the things we do at the Ethics and Public Policy Center is remind members of the elite, whether in the academy or the media, that this understanding must be remembered, that all kinds of social progressive movements were led by religious people motivated by religious concerns. And so that's what we do. And so some people think the EPPC is, quote, a religious think tank. It is not, but it's one of the few think tanks in Washington that takes religious belief and religious believers very seriously.
One of the things that you mentioned in discussing this and the founding of the EPCC was that there were a number of mainline organizations, including the World Council of Churches, that were lobbying on Capitol Hill. And that's something that we oftentimes forget, usually when we talk about religion influencing public policy. Everybody immediately jumps to the moral majority and thinks about the Christian right, so to speak, but there has been and still is, I would imagine, a fairly substantial political influence by what we would call mainstream Protestantism. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. It had a huge influence in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, especially opposing every policy that Ronald Reagan put forward. But, you know, as you well know, with the decline of the mainline membership, which has been rapid, it's also affected their ability to have much influence in Washington on public policy. They still exist. The mainline liberal lobbies still exist on Capitol Hill, but their influence has waned as their membership has also waned. And so, but they're still making pronouncements and sending out facts and emails about their concerns about any number of issues around the globe, which they have every right to do. Mm-hmm. But I found it interesting that when the media would call me and say, what in the world is Jim Dobson and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson doing being involved in public issues, I have to remind them of this history that I just explained, which is that liberal mainline Protestants have been involved in these discussions for a decade. And they go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And again, it gets to the issue of how the secular media oftentimes views this world of religion and public life. And we're going to come to how you're dealing that with the faith angle forum in a second here. But one thing that's somewhat interesting, and I've always been fascinated with think tanks in Washington, D.C., is what is the general philosophy and how you're going to influence public policy, and public policy is actually in the name of the EPC or EPPC. Is there a direct influence? Do you go to commissions in, you know, blue ribbon commissions in Congress and, you know, testify about this, that, or the other thing? Do you lobby government officials by knocking on their door and saying we have some things to say, or is there a different strategy that you have in terms of influencing public policy?
You know, it's actually, think tanks are like a university without students. We do not lobby. We try to churn out, op-eds, editorials, books, essays. The underlying belief of think tanks is that ideas have consequences, and they have consequences through the written and spoken word. And so we give a lot of speeches. We're on panels. We give lectures. In the last 3 weeks, when you've been trying to get me on this show, I've been in about five different cities where I've been on panels and given lectures to different groups about the topics we've been discussing, even here. And so the idea of think tanks is that you believe that if you get the your arguments out there in the most important media outlets, the word will trickle down to others. So we don't spend much time on Capitol Hill, although we do have some scholars here who are often consulted by members of Congress and the Senate about issues of great moment. But we don't spend a lot of time during the week. You know, we got to get this email and this fax out to members on the Hill about Bill number H.R. 546. That's not the case at all. But actually, it's more of a studious, cerebral work of people slowly and methodically churning out essays and op-eds about issues of moment currently in the news. And so what we have to say to donors is that we believe ideas have consequences, but it's a slow, methodical process. But you can see real results down the road with the way some arguments have been shaped and influenced the way people think about certain issues. So no, think tanks are not activist organizations. We do testify on the Hill when asked to do so, and oftentimes that happens, but not as much as you might think. But mainly it's through holding conferences, hosting luncheons around authors of new books that we think are important, or putting on conferences like I do, as we're going to speak about in a moment, for journalists called the Faith Angle Forum. So again, think tanks are kind of... we're working on issues that are just below the headlines, trying to shape what gets to the headlines. Does that make sense?
It does. Yes, yes. And I want to ask you about the slow, methodical process of influence, and frame that in reference to one of the initiatives that you've been working in since 1985, and that's the Evangelicals in Civic Life. Give us a flavor for what the goal of that initiative or that specific program is, and possibly how it has changed the dimensions of the debate in Washington, D.C. or nationwide.
Well, you know, that I was blessed to get a generous grant from the Pew Foundation in Philadelphia at the time. And what we did there was I was able to bring in academics, historians, sociologists, and theologians, and political scientists to talk about issues surrounding the rise of the Christian conservatives and Christian right in American politics. So I was able to edit numerous books that grew out of the papers from those conferences, where we had scholars like Robert Whitnow and George Marsden and political scientists and sociologists to talk about the proper role that religion ought to play in public life. And I was able to not only combine academics, but also bring in activists like Ralph Reed and people from Focus on the Family and Family Research Council to make sure that in that academic conversation, the leaders of these various parachurch organizations and activist groups got to listen in and be a part of that conversation. So one of the conferences I hosted was a conversation called, it was about Protestants and Catholics in discussion of the importance of natural law theory to public dialogue. And the idea was that many evangelicals involved in politics didn't have what I like to call a public grammar, an ability to speak in a public language to people who didn't agree with their theology but might agree with their politics. And so we had a whole two-day conference with Catholic and Protestant scholars to talk about the importance of natural law theory, and that became an Erdman's book called A Preserving Grace. And the idea there was just to help evangelical activists to understand that you need to learn something about natural law theory if you're going to speak to a public that doesn't always agree with your theology but might agree with your understanding of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so as issues came along, I would say with this grant, it seems to be an issue that we need to discuss. Why don't we do a conference with academics around that topic? So we did one on environmentalism. As I said, we did one on natural law. We did one called Caesar's Coin Revisited, became a book, and it was on proper understanding of Christian views of the role of the state. So in that discussion, I had a Calvinist principal pluralist, I had a libertarian from the Cato Institute who was a Christian, and I had other different views, and we discussed what different Christian views were on the role of the state in public life. And so it was an attempt to help educate the evangelical elite, if you will, about how to think responsibly and thoughtfully about the Christian role in public life. And so I that's what I did with Evangelicals in Civic Life. I still do some of it today, but again, it's all kind of related. If the funding is there, we'll do it. If it's not there right now, then we'll hold off.
I have to ask this as an academic who's mid-career and actually sliding toward retirement now, but there are days I often think that my ideas are just going out into the ether and nobody's ever listening. And when you say that ideas have consequences, I often wonder, I don't know what those consequences are. It does put food on the table when I'm teaching in class and I get paid for my teaching and my books and things. But do you have any inkling about whether the ideas that you have put forth in these conferences and luncheons and other things, have they had an influence? Is there a direct story that you could tell that says, yeah, this idea really had a real-world impact?
Oh, I think so. And we think about it all the time, Anthony, because, well, we got to report back to donors and say, you know, we're not just getting together and having a good time. We see some evidence, and so we have to chronicle it. But just anecdotally, I mean, I could say that there are certain members of the leadership of conservative Christian political involvement who have learned that you just can't come in and quote scripture on Capitol Hill and think that anybody's going to be persuaded. So they have learned something about how to make arguments that are public in nature and rooted in what theologians call general revelation. And so I could, without mentioning names, say that there have been times where we realize also the public face of evangelicalism has come across sometimes as judgmental and sanctimonious and harsh. And we've been in meetings where we say, you know, the branding of the faith publicly needs to change. And here's why. It's not faithful to the gospel. Those meetings have occurred, and really important principles have been in those meetings, and they've granted the point. And so I think that's one of the ways we see effect. As to your question about academic life, I mean, we all have to be faithful in our vocations and churn out our work and speak to students and encourage them and then, you know, plant the seeds and then let the seed grow as it will. And I think that everybody vocationally has a duty to be responsible where they are and to be faithful where they are and then let God take care of the harvest.
Yeah, it is one of those things that requires a great deal of patience, and on some days it's just hard to recognize that. But from a scholarly angle, what you just said there about changing the tenor of the evangelical dialogue really does seem to bear out, because if you trace the history of the Christian right movement from the 1970s through the 1980s and then into the 90s and in the past decade or so, you do really see a change in presentation style. And I think you might have been part of influencing that.
Well, I think so, a little bit. You know, you go from the public face of evangelicals being Jerry Falwell to the public face of evangelicals being Rick Warren. You go from the public face of evangelicals being James Dobson to now being the head of Focus on the Family, Jim Daly, which takes a different take altogether. Or you take the public face of somebody like Pat Robertson, And then you have instead people of a more gentle, persuasive persuasion. And I think that's all to the good, and I think we see real progress there. And so I'm gratified by that and grateful for it.
Now, that is talking to the public writ large, but one of the things that when you talk to the public, you have to often go through is the media. And you are running a program now called The Faith Angle that is directed toward helping the media, specifically the secular media, but I'm sure you include some of the religious media as well, help them to understand what religion is. Tell us a little bit about the nature of this program and what you do and how successful it's been.
Well, you know, it grew out of the fact that as director of the Evangelical Studies Program, I would get phone calls often from the press in the early 90s and the mid-90s, you know, asking me questions about religion and politics and evangelicals and politics. And some really smart journalists would call and ask me some really stupid questions.
I have to break in here a minute, because I just had that happen a few days ago with a journalist that tried contacting me. And the question was phrased in such a way that no matter how I answered it, I would have to answer it in a way that would not reflect how I'd want to answer it. And it just drove me crazy. I just decided not to answer it. So,
well, you know, I have a funny anecdote. It's back about 15 years ago when the Southern Baptist Convention, one of their summer conventions, was talking about what they understood to be the relationship between men and women in marriage and male headship and female submission And it got a lot of public attention, and there was a lot of debates on Crossfire about what in the world are they talking about. And I got a phone call from a reporter from the New York Times. And she said, you know, you're director of evangelical studies there, and someone told me to call you. What is going on with the Southern Baptists? I do not understand. Why are they talking this way? And I said, well, first of all, you need to understand it in the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, verses 22 and following. And she interrupted me. She said, what was that book you just mentioned? She said, who is the author? Who is the publisher? And I realized, I had to go back and say, well, first of all, I didn't mean a book. I meant a letter. It's a letter in a book called the New Testament. And it's written by a man named the Apostle Paul. And I realized that this was a very smart journalist who really had no reference point for Old and New Testament and letters of Paul. So I had to start over and go back to sort of like, this is Doctrine 101. And that's happened to me, Anthony, about six or seven times when I realized we need to host luncheons for journalists and bring in academics and scholars who really know this stuff. And, you know, from 12 to 2, put on luncheons and feed them, and then bring in top scholars. And we started doing that. And I got some funding from the Pew Foundation, and we hosted these luncheons for several years. And then I went back to Pew, and I said, you know, we're ready to renew. And the program officer said something to me that has never been said to me before or since. He said, think bigger. And I said, well, we had four lunches last year. How about six? He said, no, think bigger. I said, eight? He said, no, think as if money were not an object. What would you do? And I said, I have to call you back. And I, you know, I hung up the phone, and I took a couple weeks, and I asked a bunch of friends, you know, if money were an object, what would you do? And we came up with this idea, what about taking journalists out of Washington for 2 days and make it an invitation-only event for 20 or 22 journalists and bring in the best scholars in the world on this topic, on these topics that are in the news that they need to understand. And, you know, we started that in 1999, and we've been doing it now for 16 years, and it's been a roaring success. And it's a success because we do our best to tie our scholarly discussions of the three topics that we engage over those 2 days with what's really in the news right now. And so that I think the journalists love it, not only because we hold it in a nice venue, but we actually provide them educational material to help them understand the beat, because as they cover politics, they keep running into the faith angle. So that, for instance, at our last one, we had a whole session, and you can find this on our website, a whole session on the theology and ideology of ISIS. And we had a scholar from Princeton and a scholar from the Brookings Institution here in Washington, two of the leading scholars on understanding, you know, the radical group ISIS in the Middle East and what they're doing. And it was riveting. Or before the last presidential election, we had two sessions on understanding Mormonism. So what would it be like if Governor Romney had won the presidency to have a Mormon in the White House? And so we did that in two sessions. And they loved it because, again, they got to have a 2.5-hour briefing with leading scholars on Mormonism and public policy. And so we try very hard to link what our topics are going to be with what's been in the news recently and get the best scholar on that topic. And it's worked really well, and I think the journalists understand, you know, I'm not setting them up to make it a form of religious proselytization or persuade them any way politically, but to help them have the best resources we can find so that when they write about the story, they get it right. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's done so well.
Let me probe you a little bit on that, because I went through the list of events that you've had in the past, and you see some of the names crop up several times. And the other thing is you're pulling in academics from, you know, Princeton and a few other very fancy places. And I, from my own experience, I understand that there's this bubble that we tend to live in, and I've seen it in Washington, D.C., that the media people all hang out at the same tavern that the other media people hang out at, the academics hang out at the same places that they do, and then those two bubbles might come together. But has there been any effort to get some of these folks into what we would call flyover country? And that's been a big concern of mine in academia, that we oftentimes, being in our own bubbles, are out of touch with what average everyday people have to say. And I was looking through here, and I said, you should get some of these journalists to live in Spokane, Washington, or maybe Winfield, Kansas for a year or two. And is there any effort to just take these efforts and talk to what we would call non-bubble people or non elite policymakers out there?
Well, I guess the closest we've come to it is the way I come up with my topics is twice a year I have a host a lunch for between 8 and 10 journalists who are handpicked by me that are both politically conservative and liberal. And so David Brooks and Michael Gerson and E.J. Dionne and people from the Weekly Standard and the Atlantic Monthly, Jeffrey Goldberg, people from the Washington Post, we gather for a two-hour lunch and we say, okay, let's talk about what's in the news. What have you been reading? What are the topics you want to cover? And one of those journalists said from Newsweek said, you know, I don't know what I want to understand a megachurch. What's a megachurch? And they seem to be growing. And I said, well, I know somebody works with Rick Warren. Maybe we could get Rick Warren there. So, you know, that's not necessarily a flyover country, but we did have Rick Warren in to talk about his vision for his big Saddleback church. At one of these, somebody said, you know, I've heard about a minister in New York City named Tim Keller. Can we ever get Tim Keller there? Well, Tim's hard to get, and he actually reads the transcripts of the Faith Angle forums, and I knew he was a fan, so I know Tim, and I got a hold of him, and he said, well, you got to tell me a year out, because I'm booked. Well, I finally called him and said, you know, when next spring are you free? We'll build the conference around your ability. So we had Tim Keller there to explain, you know, why is conservative Presbyterian church thriving in New York City? But no, we have not had anybody to explain, you know, what's the meaning of Kansas or what's a mega church like in Dallas, Texas, or in Austin, Texas. But that may well come up, and it can. And we only do three topics at each one of these. We begin on a Sunday night with dinner, and then we have a Monday morning session, a Tuesday afternoon session, Monday afternoon session and a Tuesday morning session. But each of those sessions lasts 2.5 hours, and I'm the moderator of 20 journalists, so they all get to ask a lot of questions, and they're really able to dig deep down. It's a deep dive into the subject at hand, and so that's another reason why it's, I think, effective. But I will take into account what you say. I mean, it is true that the faithful are out in the middle of America also, and they need to be understood also.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you mentioned Tim Keller and Rick Warren, and they oftentimes have their own view of the world because they're jetting around to different places and giving prayer breakfasts and things like that. But, I mean, as I was going through here, I said it'd be really great if just E.J. Dionne had to go to Winfield, Kansas, and sit around for a month and then go to church with the folks at that local Presbyterian church that maybe has 150 or 200 members, because those folks make up a big part of America as well.
Well, you know, Robert Withnow, who's a sociologist friend of mine at Princeton, has written a book on religion in Texas, and he's written a book also on Kansas, and well, he's written a book on everything. But
yeah.
I have his book over here on that, and it could well be that, you know, Withnow would be the perfect guy to explain religiosity in Texas and its uniqueness. But I have to say that a lot of what we cover is what's burning in the news right now.
Yeah.
And people are saying, you know, for instance, what if a presidential candidate came out of nowhere? Well, what if Rick Perry had not had to fall out, but it moved to the top? You know, what is it unique about Rick Perry's faith that made him, if we could have said, so popular? Then we could have done one on that. But we do try to tie it to the what's in the news right now.
How much are you concerned about the vagaries of the media and going where the wind blows? I mean, that's one of the other frustrations as an academic, and I think just a person out here living in Duval, Washington. We see these topics come up in the news, and they're covered with this feeding frenzy for a day or two, and then they just disappear off the face of the earth, rather than sticking with a theme and exploring it for a long period of time. I just always kind of worry about the media picking up on the latest, greatest thing and then driving by and covering something else the next day.
Well, it's one of the challenges of their profession, isn't
it?
I mean, that's sort of what their editors are saying, what's in the news, and let's get it out there. But one of the things that I'm really excited about in our next Faith Angle in mid-November is one of the journalists said at the last lunch we had talking about topics that so many of us were so deeply moved by the response of those parishioners in the black church in Charleston, the way they responded to the killer in that courtroom. I don't know if you saw the news on that.
He did, yeah.
Where they confronted the murderer and said, you know, God have mercy on you. We forgive you. You killed my son. there was so striking, and it was really picked up by the media. Well, we've got at our next faith angle the leading African-American scholar in the country from Princeton, a man named Albert Robitaux, who's going to talk about forgiveness in the African-American church experience in America. And when I spoke to him on the phone about it, you know, he began telling me instances in history where the black church has, where people have said when they were suffering under white oppression, Father, forgive them, they know not what they're doing. And I said to him, Professor Robitaux, that's precisely what I want you to talk about. That Charleston was not an anomaly, but it was part of a progression of a people whose spirituality has been rooted in deep suffering and pain. And so this was not new to them.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have a session on that. And interesting, some of the journals are coming that have RSVP'd said, you know, I'm really excited to hear that session.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. And bring out one of the folks from that community as well, too, not just the scholar. I mean, I find, you know, one of the things we do in our program is try to talk to these folks as well and see what they say. And that's great that you're doing that. It's really good. Let me go ahead and finish up with one final question. It's a question I ask to all my guests at the end. It's a little bit of self-reflection. And looking back on your career, and is there any advice that you would give to a young person who, perhaps a 20-something-year-old millennial, who maybe was in your shoes at Georgia State at that period of the time in their life, and they have a feeling that they want to make their faith have an impact in the world? Is there anything that you would tell them? And are there any mistakes that you've learned about that if you had to rewind the tape a little bit and try it over again that you would do?
Well, one of the things I'd like to emphasize is that one of the things I see about young people who want to change the world, and they've heard at their college about the great work of William Wilberforce, who was a strong Christian abolitionist in England who helped abolish the slave trade. We have a lot of people coming to this town, Anthony, who want to be the next William Wilberforce. And I say, calm down, please. I just need you to make some photocopies for me. And what I want to say is that, first of all, before we tell young people to change the world, we need to really call them to be faithful in the ordinary task of life and to be faithful. I like to say, you know, don't plan to go out and live a life of great significance, but be significant right where you are now. And then if you're a believing Christian, leave it up to God to put you in the places where God deems you to be. And all the things that have happened to me, as I suggested earlier in this conversation, I could not have orchestrated. And I was not running around shaking hands and networking. They just happened, and I can't think that they're providential. But so I would say to young people, as I say to my own children, you know, you really need to prepare now for whatever surprise God may have for you, and prepare in a way that you're ready when the time comes to do the task that you've been given. And there's a new book out by a theologian out there on the West Coast named Michael Horton called Ordinary. And I highly recommend it, because what Horton is arguing in that book is that, you know, God calls most of us just to be faithful in our ordinary task. And we keep telling kids to go out and change the world. I was once asked, I went down to speak at a Christian college in Tennessee, and somebody from the International Justice Mission was on the phone with me before I went down there. He said, when you go down to that chapel, tell the kids to, when they leave school, to go out and change the world in Sudan, and change the sexual trafficking injustices that are occurring in China, and change it. And I listened to him, but then I went down to the chapel and I said, I was encouraged to tell you this, but I'm precisely going to tell you the opposite. Go and change your dorm room. Learn to love your roommate. And be in touch with your parents who you've neglected for months, who are paying for your education. In other words, be faithful in these small things. Change your dorm before you talk about changing the world. And then you'll be ready to be protruded out into the larger things. But you got to be faithful in the smaller things first. And I think that's really important.
I think that is an important lesson. It's one that as I grow older, I learn even more, because I was one of those young idealistic youths that wanted to change everything immediately, and realize that can be a frustrating task sometimes, but if we just change things in our local community and the people right next to us, it can have a major impact throughout the world. My guest today has been Michael Cromartie. Did I pronounce that correct?
Yes, Cromarty, yes.
Cromarty. My guest today has been Michael Cromarty. Michael, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It's been a great privilege. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.